from his El Accidente album from 1998. Enjoy your Mother's Day, folks.
Listening to WJFC Agra, Creative Community Magical Radio.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Agra or anytime at WGXC.org.
Turnout on Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the WGXC Catskill Studio to learn about Wavefarm's WGXC, tour the studio, record a station ID or PSA, or pick up a sticker. The WGXC Catskill Studio is located at 393 Main Street in Catskill. Come on by for a visit and see how you can get involved in your local community radio station.
Wavefarms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Tail Campriel of Athens, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
no sympathy. Ain't love ever free. Bunny's a rider, saddle I can't find her. No sympathy.
To missives to the ether. Oops, sorry, didn't mean to do that. So welcome to Missives to the Ether. I'm Kat Tice. That was a remix of Bunny is a Writer by Caroline Polachek. This is WGXC from ACRA, live from Catskill Studio. You're listening to Listener Supported Radio. Thank you so much for being here, and I'm so excited to welcome my wonderful guest, Bobby Abate, who is a queer artist, filmmaker, editor, whose work has been showcased at the Museum of Modern Arts, Mediascope series in New York, the New York Film Festival, the Guggenheim in Bilbao, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, the San Francisco Cinematheque, and International Objects in New York City. He has done residencies at the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council Art Space and the Constance Saltonstall Foundation in Ithaca and the VCCA in Amherst, Virginia. They are also the recent recipient of the Princess Grade Special Projects and Latent International Artists Exchange Program. Bobby is also an amazing video editor and most notably edited seasons 3 and 4 of the docuseries We're Here on HBO. And one of the reasons that I, or maybe the main reason, dare I say, that Bobby is here today is to talk about the Outsider Tarot that he created. It was published in 2021 and is now sold out. Is part of the permanent collection at the Harvard Fine Arts Library and the Peabody Essex Museum in Massachusetts. I have a personal affinity to this project. We used to share a studio in Brooklyn in a different lifetime. I have witnessed that project from sketches on the wall to actual cards in a deck, and had the pleasure to be part of gatherings where we would and we'll talk about this more. I remember throwing cards from the Outsider Tarot and interpreting them and kind of having experiences with them. But we played with many decks. But we'll talk more about kind of that time of research and process. It was extremely formative for me. And lastly, Bobby, I mentioned, is a wonderful filmmaker, and they've just recently completed filming The Ghost at Skeleton Rock, with a premiere planned for late 2025. Please welcome Bobby Abate. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here with you. This is I love doing radio, especially this type of radio. So I'm so happy to be with you on this Mother's Day afternoon.
Yes, yes. It's a beautiful, beautiful Mother's Day. I guess, you know, there's so much I want to talk about, and a lot, starting off with, you are someone that I have always known that has incorporated spirit, the spiritual, the journey of understanding self within your art practice across many disciplines. And I guess I'd love to kind of hear any your thoughts about kind of that in general before we kind of dive into maybe the Outsider Tarot and kind of where that, how that gestated and became.
I think I would bring it right back. I'm at my mom's house right now, so I'm surrounded by all these religious statues and everything. But growing up in the Roman Catholic Italian American family, there was a lot of spirituality. So, you know, there's always saint statues around, everything's in threes, and there was a lot of, you know, superstitions and everything that were kind of steeped in my upbringing. You know, for instance, like in my tarot deck, there is still Saint Teresa, and there's the whole suit of roses. So every time my grandmother saw a rose, she took it as a communication and answered prayer from specifically from Saint Teresa. So I love that idea of like really paying attention to nature. I love how that like made her pay attention to nature. Every time she saw a rose, it meant that there was an answer. So it just came from there. You know, I just really grew up believing in power and spirituality and essence, even as the Roman Catholic Church was like turned against me as a queer person. There was a spirituality in our house that felt like witches. And, you know, and my grandmother and I grew up watching, well, she didn't grow up, but I grew up watching Bewitched with her every night. I would go down to her house and we'd watch Bewitched. And as I got bullied in school, I would pretend to be a witch. And that's how I, you know, I mean, just to like, of course, I was obsessed with Endora the most, so I would think I was Endora, and I would twinkle like my bad energy away. So I kind of took all of that with me. And then when I went to Mass Art in college in Boston, I was surrounded, my roommate was goth, and my friend brought a tarot deck, the Tarot of the Cat People, with her. And I was like, what is this? My mom told me never to touch one, and we did that very secretly, and I fell in love with the tarot, and that's where I really first started to try to make a tarot deck. And I failed at that moment, but I started trying to make like three or four tarot decks when I was 17.
Wow. Yeah, no, I know. I can relate to that. I, you know, also being raised Catholic, but from a Puerto Rican kind of with a little tinge of Santeria from my grandmother's side, like yeah. I think like there's like a sense of like feeling like there's messages everywhere. You know, yes. if you're willing to like look for them, you know, and kind of keep your eye out, you know, it's like a language from the universe for sure.
So beautiful to like think about, especially now with the smartphones and all the digital stuff that, you know, kind of takes up our lives. Like it's so much more important to listen to nature, to listen to the real world, the natural world.
Yeah.
You know, ever before. So we were lucky to get those lessons.
I agree. Yeah. And also just like kind of being able to discern an experience of chance. I mean, I do believe that there is some, you know, if you go into like the logic of like a digital glitch and kind of what's the message within that. Like, I think there's definitely a different conversation kind of in the digital realm for sure. But being able to discern what is happening in a happenstance way that wasn't supposed to be there, and kind of being able to notice that off a screen is just really important. So yeah, I am dying to just die, you know, I feel like I can't even remember like how far along, like by the time we were hanging out, you were really kind of drawing through the Outsider Tarot. Well, actually let's start from the beginning. Can you explain for those who may not be familiar, what is the Outsider Tarot?
The Outsider Tarot is a tarot deck that draws upon the energy of outsiders that have existed, artists, queers, revolutionaries, scientists, any outliers, people who thought differently in the past. So it pays homage to them, and it takes out, like from a regular tarot deck, all the kind of generic or kind of, you know, just the figures, the archetypical figures, and replaces them with real people that existed and have lived lives and experience. So it's to take wisdom from them, from the ether. So Rachel Pollack, who was a resident of the Catskills, is there on the Three of Bottles with Eden Gray, who brought the tarot to popular consciousness in the 60s. She got to see that card. She had the card hanging on her wall. She passed away, sadly, very last year. But she was very honored and amazed and happy to be part of the deck. And she's the one that actually inspired me to finally create the deck. I met with her. She was a colleague of my partner, my husband, Douglas Martin, at Goddard when it was still a college, a writing program. And I met with her, and she showed me her tarot deck and her book, 80 Degrees of Wisdom, 78 Degrees of Wisdom. My deck has 80 cards. And that made me understand the tarot in the most fundamental systemic way. That's how I got into making a deck, actually, is like, I can't understand and memorize a little white book and what each card means. I want to know why it means that. Like, I don't want to be told, like, you know, the Ten of Wands means like being burdened. I want to know why it, like, what's underneath it. And reading Rachel's book, like, opened up that system of the tarot for me in such an inviting way. And then I could really nerd out and get, like, into, like, the real, real Kabbalistic, esoteric, like, nitty-gritty of each single card and really study them. So that's what the Outsider Tarot takes apart, all the esoteric frameworks, and rebuilds it with the... also with the variable of outsider energy in it. And so that's how I came upon all of the art for each card. And then the other big thing is the major arcana. I took the figures out. So the major arcana are supposed to represent the querent, the person that's doing the reading. Mm-hmm. And so all of those are set pieces, costumes, and props with no figures in them at all, and very stripped down, beautiful, like pared down imagery. So that you can picture yourself in them. So each one has like a meditation and you just get inside of the card. So I really wanted the majors to be about the outsider who's doing the readings for themselves.
Right. Can you say a little bit more about kind of how, because you reframed all, you know, like what, you know, for those who are familiar with the Rider-Waite, which is kind of like the OG deck for a lot of people, not everybody, of course, but you know, the way you brought in, you know, you mentioned kind of your relationship to roses and how that became part of the minor arcana and bottles. Yeah. Like, can you break that down a little bit for the audience?
Yeah, I replaced all the suits with. So I was just paying very particular attention to the imagery that I was bringing into my artwork and my films and through my childhood. So, and so they went back to the elemental fire instead of wands. I reassociated them with light bulbs because I've always had a total fascination and obsession with the light bulb from such a young age. And a lot of my artwork involved light bulbs when I first started college, and it still remains that way. I really am obsessed with the light bulb as being this like little universe in glass. Mm-hmm. And then bottles, that was a hard one. At first it was shells, but I mean, I thought bottles were a little basic, but I do also have this like real obsession with bottles.
Yes.
At a young age, like I always collected these little tiny bottles, and I love them as vessels. And I love the way Rachel talked about the element of water as being consciousness that needs shape. So bottles give like different water, different shapes, and bottles come in like, you know, human shapes. So you'll see them in my deck. They come in every single shape that you can imagine, and they're destroyed, and, you know, they're vessels. They become like witchcraft vessels. And then eyes is based on the idea of air and anima, like the soul. So that replaces swords. So the eyes are the window to the soul. And eyes are huge in all of my artwork. They still are. I love eyes. Even my film that I just am editing about to send into Color Correct, such beautiful close-up of eyes. So like the eyes tell us everything. So they feel inherently associated to air. And then roses became the suit of earth. The one thing that Arthur Waite did that was very interesting with the suit of coins was he made it the suit of pentacles, because he was talking about this access of materialism and spirituality. So they're gold coins with pentacles on them. Mm-hmm. I love that. So I think roses are an even better example of that, because roses go to market. They're very, they can be very expensive. They're a commodity, but they're also spiritual, and they grow out of the earth. Mm-hmm. And so there's something that they've also been cultivated. There's the wild rose that's like very un-rose-like if you come across one, the original primitive rose. And then there's these beautiful, cultivated, gorgeous roses that we see. And there's the question of, do we propagate roses, or do we take roses from the rose hip and the seed? And so that felt very poignant to me to have as the suit of earth.
I love that. I love that. And I love how, you know, it's one thing I've been kind of thinking about a lot in just kind of my relationship to tarot is like kind of thinking about, you know, and it's sort of related to kind of, you know, writing a tale or writing a story is kind of thinking about the querent being a sort of protagonist of the journey, and I like that framework, especially when I'm reading for others, to kind of take it off of them, you know, especially when there's some real stuff that's showing up. Now I want to read with your deck, just to kind of explore that kind of spaciousness that you offer to the querent in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Querent is the most important thing. I mean, I feel like a lot of tarot decks, like they kind of, they in a way shut the querent out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I wanted to invite them literally inside of the space to have a meditation in all the majors, that they can like put the, you know, the cape of the witch on and be on the broomstick, you know?
Yeah.
And imagine themselves flying through the universe.
It's empowering, you know, and I think kind of just like going along, like if, you know, it's the outsider tarot, it's for those who feel left out for whatever reason, kind of like being like, no, this is a safe place for you to be. I love that. So I mentioned this. So, you know, we shared a studio for a time, and you would invite folks of varying knowledges of the tarot. I felt like I knew the least. I knew nothing. I'll be honest. I knew nothing at the time. And I remember asking you one time, why do you keep inviting me to these things? you said, like, you know, you're intuitive. That was enough for me to kind of feel invited in to kind of be part of that improvisational discourse. But I love, you know, and I never asked you, I sensed it was part of the process of developing the deck, but I've never asked you directly. So I'm asking you now, why were you doing that?
That was a huge part of it. I mean, I think when I first started making the tarot deck, I was doing it, like, I was also new to the tarot, to be honest. Like, I read Rachel's book, and then I kept buying deck after deck. At that point, I probably owned 100 decks, and I would read with them incessantly. And so I felt like a newbie too, because there's no better way to learn the tarot than to create each card. So each card I created, there's 80 cards in my final deck, but I have created maybe literally 400 or 500 cards in the space. Well, the deck, to tell everyone, you know, took a decade to make.
Yeah.
So I did not rush that process whatsoever. So inviting you and inviting all these people over to, I would always have these huge tarot events at my apartment in the very beginning, and I would give everyone free readings.
Yes, you did.
It was part of the process. So when I first started designing the deck, they were black and white drawings that I printed out at home. And I cut them into cards myself on cardstock. So it was absolutely vital to get the feedback from you. Is this card saying anything to us? And there were cards that just didn't work. There was a whole suit that didn't work that I just got rid of. And then the major arcanas in the first rounds actually had figures in them. So it was a constantly unfolding collaborative process. I literally couldn't have created the deck without you and without Peggy, who lives like right up the street.
Peggy Yavish, our neighbor. Hope you're listening.
And, you know, who would come over all the time, and Risa Puleo, and you know, all the and Constantina, and Amal Dublon. You know, everybody would come over, and in Valentine, we would have all these amazing readings together. It was a really special moment in history. And we had a group name. It was called Esoterico. We had a group name, and we would do esoteric events. Robin was there that was doing I Ching. Each of us brought a little superpower. We were like the... we were like a band of a super little
queer weirdo witches.
Yeah, weirdo superhero witches. We had our own little coven.
It was
really important. Really important at that time that we built our power. We saw what was coming. Tina's an astrologer. Mm-hmm. She saw in the cards what was coming in 2016 that we're still living through now. So she saw that coming, and I felt like we were building our power, our strength. And the Outsider Tarot came at a time where we needed it, it was released in 2020, like right 2021, in the middle of the pandemic. And I've had people write me say that the deck, got them through a really hard time. There's people that tattooed the cards mm-hmm. on their bodies. And even last week, a couple of weeks ago, I was at Petco. Somebody stopped me and said, "Are you Bobby Abate? I have your deck, and it's gotten me through so many hard times." That's all because we did what we did together at that moment.
That's giving me shivers. I love that. And I kind of a digression, but the minute you mentioned Tina, I remember also around that time her telling me that that was a time when the two, like, because she's closer to our age, so she's more Gen X, Exennial realm, and she felt it was the time for like the younger generations, like we had to align and kind of go into queer intergenerational alignment to be prepared for now.
Yes.
And that was like something that she would say a lot, and I really kind of see that truth too as well.
We had a powerful group,
heavy hitters or queer witches that were also making some amazing art, and Tina was in the last Whitney Biennial, so this is awesome, and I one question I always get. Especially when I do my tarot club, which is very much inspired by those gatherings, and where it's a lot of just kind of collective practice of like just practicing reading for yourself and reading for others together. And people always ask me about starting a deck or making a deck, and I obviously can't answer because I haven't made one. But you can. And I want to know, what would be your advice for someone who feels called to do so, to make a tarot deck?
To take the time to understand the framework, I think, is the most important thing. That, like, whatever the deck is that you're attached to, a lot of people are attached to the Rider-Waite deck, but there, of course, were decks before that. And that came out of different practices and different systems. So to understand the system that you are finding yourself attached to, and to bring yourself into it, right? Like, I mean, I know like a lot of decks out there that I see are simply just visual recreations of the Rider-Waite deck. Mm-hmm. And I honestly do find those the most disappointing, because I don't see like them diving deep. Like I don't find them as interesting if it's just the Rider-Waite deck with modern imagery, or even if they are inclusive. Like I feel like I like the decks that dive really deep and go wild, right? Like Rachel Pollack's deck, the Shining Tribe deck, goes wild, right? And the Mother Piece deck is another one that goes wild. Mm-hmm. So I really, really think that those decks, there's just these decks out there that bring a whole other system inside of it. And those are the ones I love the most. And I really love the decks that predate the Rider-Waite, or there's another deck. I mean, Arthur Waite famously hated this person named, I'm going to butcher his name, Eudes Piccard, who created a deck in the same exact year in France. Mm. And is... the informant of the entire Spanish school of tarot. And he came up with his whole system of tarot, also 78 cards, that's really gorgeous and beautiful. And I've always wanted to do a remake of that. But and you can understand where he came from. It's a little bit more obscure. But yeah, to really get into the roots, to really understand, it's like either you pick the flower just for the flower, or you understand the roots, where it needs to grow, the nutrients that make it grow, the magic that makes the flower that it is, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the differences in tarot decks to me.
Mm-hmm. The Outsider Tarot is sold out. First edition is completely sold out now, correct?
Yes, yeah. It's been sold out for almost 7-8 months now. Yeah.
Yeah, and
a few secret decks that are my own that I mean I've kept it like, you know, about 20 of them. Just I can't have them all go, but yeah.
No. Yeah, I need to get one. But any thoughts about reprinting, or is that on the horizon? I know you've been really busy making a movie, which we'll talk about in a second, but.
That will be reprinted, like, you know, next probably. It's needed now. So again, so yeah, it's definitely going to get reprinted. I just, going to put some time aside to add new outsiders into the deck. Like there's just a lot of people that, you know, I feel like need to be added in, and some can be cycled out. They exist in the first to the second edition. And I'm also creating a new deck right now, which is based on the secret gay language of Polari. Mm. It's based on a fortune telling deck that was printed in the 30s here in the United States. And it has a derogatory name of the Gypsy Witch fortune telling deck. So I'm going to get rid of that, but it was mass produced. I like that was produced in America, and it just has, 36 cards with images like cloud, snake, safe. I'm replacing them with Polari words and imagery. And it's going to be a queer spell casting protection fortune telling deck. So, the other thing I didn't mention is I don't believe in fortune telling through the tarot. A lot of people do, but I think of tarot as being almost like a spiritual gauge of the moment, like a wind test, barometer. And so I believe that the querent always has complete and utter agency but what the tarot does is it senses where you've come from, where you are, and it gives you a trajectory outside of that, like a map, like a forecast of where you're heading when you're thinking about the future, and that you can always change it. So, and then when we were setting up today, I pulled up a card just for the reading. Mm-hmm. I did a reading just before we went on the air, and I got the Tower. And the Tower's, famously considered a bad card, but that's actually my card.
Tower. Here.
Tower's great. And my tower has a radio tower in it. So it's like, it was so crazy because we're doing a radio show. So sometimes the tarot just aligns imagery in the most beautiful way. And Rachel has a very funny story about the tower, that she got it. She got very scared. And then she went for a walk down her dogs took her down a road that was really beautiful. And she realized she was on Tower Road.
Oh.
So she was a big advocate of this, like, don't always think you always have to open yourself up to the full intuitive power of the tarot as well, that like not everything is always going to be written, that sometimes it speaks through the images. It has 78 images and cards to communicate to you with, so it's gonna sometimes it's gonna subvert the meanings. Mm-hmm. to suit the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I often kind of when I do a reading, I preface and saying, like, we're not predicting the future here. This is simply a mirror that hopefully you're able to really look at. And we're going to look at it together.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
You learn just as much when someone's like, oh, that's not true.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm like, oh, and then my Claires are like, kind of like, let's focus on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's what I feel like. It's like more of like a doctor where it's like, kind of like you touch something and you're like, ow, that hurts. Like that didn't hurt. And I'm like, kind of like, oh, let's just focus here. Like maybe let's put the X-ray.
Well, we've done the love readings when somebody's like, I just want to know if they're in love with me. And then you get the card. It's like, it doesn't look like it. And then they're like, that's not true. That's not true. I'm like, okay.
Cool. Okay. Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I'm so excited about this new deck. I'm so excited that Outsider Tarot will be coming back. I want to, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, because you do bring so much of this practice into your other creative work. I know you've been going for it. Like, I never see you anymore because you're just so busy doing so many awesome things. I know you have an art show that's opening up and you've been working on a new film, which is so exciting. Let's start with art first. What's going on with that? I mean, it's all art, but you know what I mean?
The tarot deck was my transition into art. I was editing a lot of television and I was getting very upset and sad by it because a lot of it was reality TV. And my father at the same time got dementia back in 2010 and it became very intense and overbearing. So I really just wanted to stop staring at a computer all the time. And I went into college as a painting major and a sculpture major, and I was always working with my hands. And then, you know, being a filmmaker and a video editor, a television editor, I was just always staring at a computer. I am now too.
but
like at that moment, I just really wanted to be in converse, just physical medium. So that's what brought me to doing the tarot. And it really just connected me back to my 2D practice. Mm-hmm. And so after the tarot got published and the Outsider Tarot got published in 2021, I found myself at the end of a space that I was like, now you have to reopen your visual practice completely. It can't all be tarot. And I just really challenged myself and started doing all just painting and drawing like in set just all the time. And thankfully, like the work that I did got me into the LMCC. And that's been a huge part of my life with my going to residencies and focusing on all my paintings and 2D drawings, 2D work. I do a gravel practice that's akin to these 1950s kitsch pieces that have some queer history involved. I'm very involved with like looking back at queer history. Before it was just being in reverence of the history that's been destroyed and fragmented. It's like doing like a Nancy Drew investigation into our past, mm-hmm. and understanding where our ancestry is. But now in this new administration, it's also like become a little bit of like a cautionary tale about what we're heading back into. Like it scares me particularly to see what's happening mm-hmm. now and how the queer community is being, you know, vilified that we're going back to these places, especially when it comes to gender and being transgender, how restrictive it was and how, you know, in the 60s, if you weren't wearing three articles of clothing that were aligned with the gender that was on your ID, you would be arrested. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago. So, you know, having done all that research, I feel very scared. I just did a residency in Portugal that was under a dictatorship from 1930 to 74 under Salazar. And I got to go to the Judiciary Police Archives, which is kind of a little bit like the FBI. And they would tail and do investigations on suspected or reported homosexuals. And they have all those files. So I got to see the files and surveillance photographs that they took. And read all these handwritten things about like witness testimony. And it was, you know, it was very creepy mm-hmm. and very similar to where we kind of are now, you know, where things seem to be going. So mm-hmm. My practice as a 2D artist is a lot about investigation, histories, personal history, and the history of the queer community. Mm-hmm. And I have my first solo show actually opening up this Saturday in Narrowsburg, New York at the DVAA Alliance Gallery. So
exciting, exciting. You know, I feel like this would be a good, I mean, we might have already kind of covered the terrain because it's, you know, it's inherent just with you kind of going towards the tarot as an art project. But do you find yourself using ritual to inform your creative practice that's not tarot? Like, you know, do you do do you do things before you start? You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be so specific, but I feel like part of the main thing that we talk about on this is kind of, you know, what are the kind of the practices that inform or open up that portal?
Artwork is it's all ritual, right? So I think I learned a lot from making my tarot deck. I love working with assignments anyway. Mm. So I create a long series a lot. I love to create series and series that allow me to investigate.
Oh, so
the creation of my work is ritual. Like it is ritual, like painting is ritual. And I very specifically paint with ink and not just actual ink, like fountain pen inks, mm-hmm. because of the way they stain the paper. It really feels like, it just feels like very spiritual, like memories being like burned into the page, mm-hmm. and the way it moves. It goes back to that Rachel Pollack, this idea of like water being consciousness, mm-hmm. and I'm giving it shape. So like mm-hmm. the ink is very watery. So I love to move that water around. Mm-hmm. And even when I did my residency at Salt and Stahl last summer in Ithaca, which if you're an artist, that's an amazing space to go, nonprofit space to go to apply to for artists, New York artists. It's like I had a studio and I was able to water my whole paper down and really play with the idea of water on the surface. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it is very spiritual for me. And I talk to my therapist about it all the time, but like, if I'm not making art, I am not mentally like sound, right?
Same.
Like needs to happen. Like
yes.
I just, how I process the world. It has been since I was 13 years old. I just turned to my art.
Yes. I get it.
It's integral. It's so important to me.
Totally. Totally. Cool. Okay. So switch another redirect, but not really that much. So tell me about this new film and how does spirit play a role? I feel like it probably does, but how?
The film, every single piece of mine is connected. So the yes. film is called The Ghost at Skeleton Rock. I've written a bunch of screenplays. This screenplay I happened to write 20 years ago. It's a version of my coming out story, my first time, my first experience. And it was back in 1992. And after this first experience, as a young person, I really couldn't wait to have it. Mm-hmm. After it was over, all the terror I felt the next morning, because that was also the height of the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
And it's a very specific moment where I think as gay men, like when you had, or anyone actually, when you had intimacy, the next morning came a fear of death. Like, oh, that was such an amazing, wonderful, fun night. And then the next morning it's like, I'm going to die. Like it was very particular to that window of time. Mm-hmm. And when we did a test screening on Thursday of the film, and it was, people were crying, and the people that are around my age were like, I've never even seen this story told on film before, mm-hmm. that moment. But it was a huge cloud that was cast over our intimacy, our lives, mm-hmm. for like a decade. And for all of us, our first times.
Mm-hmm.
Really kept us away in a lot of ways. You know, it was a choice you made,
mm-hmm.
You know, to take a risk. You know, even if you use protection, there was still a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there was all the misinformation, and there was society that was like against you, you know,
mm-hmm.
going to church and hearing the priest say, you know, AIDS is God's punishment, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's when I was, you know, in high school,
mm-hmm.
and junior high, hearing these messages. So this film is about that moment, and the way I broke up with the person that I was first with was with a Ouija board. So I was so full of terror, and I was talking to this ghost named Chris that I believe had passed away from AIDS. And the person I was with wanted to keep seeing me, and so I said, you're just going to need Chris's approval. And so I used the Ouija board to break up with him, and it got a little bit scary, actually.
Oh. Wait, so, from the board or from the person?
Well,
or Chris, I'm remembering the movie.
The spirit Chris had the power to give nightmares to anyone.
Oh.
So after that session, the person I was with said that he had been getting nightmares every single night and was very upset. Which I didn't ask Chris to do it. So Chris was, you know, a manifestation a lot of ways of my fear.
Yeah.
And also I think I just broadcast that fear into the other person.
Right.
So the film harnesses also that ambiguity of like how we externalize our fears. And it does a good job, I believe, of like how I work with esoterics and, you know, I still don't, you know, I still believe Chris was a real spirit, a real entity that I contacted. And, you know, the film, we felt him filming there. You know, we did the auditions and the camera shut off when they were talking about Chris, and there was lots of stuff happening there. So it was quite a moment.
Wow.
It's a narrative film, and it was produced by Todd Stevens, who did Gypsy 83 and Edge of 17. And Brian Hubbard is the cinematographer. It's the most gorgeous film. The acting is incredible. We had 1,500 actors audition for us, submit their tapes. So we have literally the best of the best. And the test screening was through the roof. So I can't wait to premiere it.
I can't wait to see it. I'm so excited. Okay, well, I think this is our perfect segue to go into playing some music. And you very sweetly, we chatted about some music we wanted to play and hear. And you had mentioned one of my personal faves, Bjork, from her incredible record, which I haven't listened to in a really long time, debut. And you suggested that we play Come to Me. And before we go into that, I wanted to hear, you know, if you wanted to speak, you've said a lot about the film, but like maybe kind of how it connects to the film before we go into that, and say goodbye to you and thank you for joining us and being on Waveform.
Oh, thank you for having me. First of all, it's been a very magical afternoon that echoes our time together through all these years. And Come to Me it was an important song to me when it came out. It was just this magical, hypnotic, sonar plunking orchestral thing that brought me into a state every time I heard it. It is the opening song of the film right now. We're trying to license it and through Bjork. Hopefully she's...
This is a manifestation, Bjork.
Like, I'm going to do it.
Bjork, come on. We're manifesting here. Come on, Bjork.
It captures all that angst. I've been listening to Bjork a lot, and I didn't quite pick up how love longing she was in those first few albums. Mm-hmm. Really, really just heartbroken through a lot of it. And I just love her so much now. Like, I have so much extra love for her than I already had so much. So this is the crown jewel of Bjork for me.
Fabulous. Well, on that note, let's listen to Bjork and some other stuff before we run out of time. Thanks, Bobby. Thanks for listening to Listener Supported Radio, WGXC.
Thank you. You're not alone. not ashamed. You know they love.